Southwest at 8, 62 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from the first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program at carthage.edu/aspire. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg.
It's a broken heart, babe. I know the sound. Feels like your hands are nailed to the ground. It'll pass just like everything else.
And that terrific music is courtesy of a very, very talented bluegrass folk rock band called Trampled by Turtles. What a great name, and what talented musicians. And we are talking today with a member of Trampled by Turtles, mandolin player Eric Berry, because Trampled by Turtles is going to be coming to southeastern Wisconsin for an appearance on Sunday, September 1st, for the Labor of Love Music Festival, a major fundraiser for the Just Live organization to lift up the issue of suicide prevention. And I have already heard from all kinds of Facebook friends who are huge fans of Trampled by Turtles and are so excited about their upcoming visit. And I'm excited to speak with Eric Berry, who is a charter member of Trampled by Turtles since their creation back in 2003. He joins us from by the telephone. Eric Berry, we welcome you to the morning show.
Hi, good morning.
I am really, really happy to be speaking with you. I know the group is based in Duluth. Is that where you're speaking from this morning?
Yes, it is.
Tell me a little bit, first of all, about where you come from originally. Is Duluth your original stomping grounds?
Actually, I'm the only member of the band who is not from Minnesota. I'm from southern Wisconsin myself. I'm from Verona, which is a Madison suburb.
Yeah, right. Very good. Tell us about what life was like in Verona and at what point music started to become an important part of your life.
I don't remember it not being a part of my life. My parents, to their credit, but I always phrase it like I resent it, made me take piano lessons before I can remember starting to do that. One of the really wonderful things about Verona was it had a great music program in the high school, so it was very easy for me to challenge myself and push myself with opportunities before I even graduated from high school.
What did you do instrumentally aside from the piano? At what point did the mandolin enter the picture for you?
The mandolin is my last instrument that I acquired, and that was that was about 20 years ago. I played a viola and saxophone and oboe within the school program, and I played guitar. I played jazz guitar with the school program too, and guitar really was a big focus for me. I entered college as a classical guitar major, And for one reason and another, that didn't really pan out for me. But one of the opportunities that I got from that was I started playing electric bass in bands. Other musicians would be like, hey, Barry, it turns out our bass player can't make Friday's gig. Can you learn these songs? And sure, I'll do that. That sounds like fun. And that was a lot of fun. And when I first picked up a mandolin, I was interested in no longer being the seventh person with a guitar at a campfire, is what my motivation was. And what I discovered was a lot of the stuff I'd learned how to do and was interested in doing and loved doing on guitar and bass, I could do on mandolin without interfering with other guitar players or bass players, if that makes sense. I could play bass lines on it, but it was so high in the register that it wasn't bass lines anymore.
Right. So it added its own little color to the texture.
Absolutely. And, you know, in the late 90s, there weren't a lot of them floating around. I know for a fact that the first time I played mandolin in public was at a college house party in Moorhead, Minnesota in 1998, and I had a friend playing banjo, and we were not very good. We were not, and if we'd been two guitar players at that party playing at that caliber, people would have told us to stop. But instead, we had an entire room entranced, and I'm certain it's because they'd never seen mandolins or banjos live in their lives.
Hmm. Before I ask you a little bit about Trampled by Turtles specifically, I'd love to hear a little more about the instrument of the mandolin and how it relates to the guitar. I mean, how transferable is the technique of the more common instrument, the guitar, to its rare cousin, the mandolin? I mean, is it very much the same thing?
It's very similar. They both trace their roots back to the lute in the Renaissance era, but the guitar has six strings, and it's called a single chorused instrument. So there's only one E string, for example. The mandolin has got eight strings, but it's four pairs of strings. So the lowest note open string on a mandolin is a G. I don't think of it as playing two G strings when I play that string. And I just use it as a singular word. But there are two of them. It's kind of like a 12-string guitar in that regard, but the strings are in unison. And the mandolin is tuned exactly like a violin, whereas the guitar is tuned, it's tuned differently.
So the fingerings are all completely different then?
Fingerings are completely different. The techniques otherwise are the same. Like when I first started playing mandolin, I knew how to fret a note, I knew how to hold a pick, but I had to learn the fingerings. And I quit playing guitar forever. I don't remember if I was playing guitar or mandolin, but I played the wrong fingerings on the instrument, and I was just like, this is too confusing. I'm only ever playing this one.
And you picked the mandolin. Which is a much smaller instrument, of course. How tricky is that? I mean, how much does it feel like very, not just specifically different fingerings, but also the fact that you're, in a sense, I should think, using your hand in kind of a different way than you would on the larger instrument, the guitar?
To be honest, it's something I don't even notice anymore, so I don't feel like I can speak really intelligently about that. I will say this, that when I'm having a really good night and I'm feeling like everything I want to do, I'm doing, my hands feel even bigger. which is a completely mental phenomena, but obviously at a certain point it's like, yeah, this isn't too small.
We're speaking with Eric Barry, who is the mandolin player for a fine bluegrass group called Trampled by Turtles, who are going to be appearing here in southeastern Wisconsin on Sunday, the 1st of September, at the Labor of Love Music Festival out in New Munster. So tell us about your road into Trampled by Turtles, and it sounds like you were there right from the beginning. Tell us the story of how this wonderful group was put together.
Well, we started up in Duluth, Minnesota, and we started as a four-piece, and currently we have six members. Nobody's ever left, though, so the original four guys are still there.
Wow, and I can't tell you how rare it is to hear that. So that's cool. How did the four of you know each other or find each other? How was it that you were all in Duluth at the time?
So two of the guys went to Duluth to go to school, to UMD, to University of Minnesota Duluth. And then the other two of us, myself and our bass player, Tim Saxhog, we actually moved up there to play music. Our Tim and my stories are a little different, but at the end of the day, it's we had the opportunity to join bands that were based out of Duluth, and so we took that opportunity and moved up to do that. Our banjo player, Dave Carroll, moved up to go to school, and so did our lead singer and guitar player, Dave Simonette. And Dave was in a band that was playing a lot. Dave Simonette, I should say. And Tim was in a band that was playing a lot. And I was in a band that was playing a lot. And I actually played bass in that band. And so we knew each other through that experience. You know, our bands would play bills together. The first time I ever met Dave Simonette, he and his... it was the drummer in his band. They came out to watch our band play because we had a weekly gig on Thursdays and he had a weekly gig on Thursdays and they had a Thursday off. So they were like, well, let's check out the other Thursday night band. And they introduced themselves to us at set break, which was pretty fun. And we wound up jamming a few songs together that night. And that's from 2001. And there's an old photo floating around of that, which is pretty cool.
Because that really is the beginning in many respects.
I think Dave and Tim might have played together even earlier than that. But when what became Trampled started rolling together, a few different things were happening. One of them was that I had rediscovered discovered my mandolin, because I didn't really play it when I moved up to Duluth because I was focusing on playing bass in this band and doing some other stuff. So I was playing it again and looking to play it with somebody. Dave Simonette actually had his electric guitar stolen, and so by default was focused on doing acoustic stuff. And Dave and Tim had been put together in a special project that a local guy who owned Pizza Luce had put together for his birthday, and they had discovered they could sing together very well. And then Dave Simonette and I had played a couple of duo shows, and Dave Carroll, our banjo player, saw one of those and came up and introduced himself to us and said, I play banjo, and I was hearing banjo parts in my head to you guys. So, you know, kind of these different things are happening. You know, like three of us are, like, friendly with each other. Dave's looking to do something acoustic. I'm looking to play mandolin. Dave Carroll's looking to play banjo with somebody. And Dave Simonette and Tim Saxhog had discovered that they sing together really well. And this is all kind of happening in the summer through the fall of 2002.
Right. So it's just like the timing was propitious for all of you. You're all in the right time and the right place to just kind of come together.
Pretty much, you know, and there really isn't like a, I mean, like, I remember the moment that Dave Carroll came up to Dave Simonette and I and said, hey, guys, let me give you my phone number. I play banjo. Please call me. But, and I don't want to take anything away from that moment, but it's not particularly dramatic either. You know what I mean? And they're all kind of like that. It's just a really natural, like, oh, we should, you know, I know a guy who plays bass, and he can sing really well. Let me call him. Like, oh, it's Tim? I know Tim. Tim's great. You know, that kind of thing.
Right. So it's not like the clouds parted and the angels were singing. It just sort of happened, and here you are all these years later, still together.
Right. And even the way the other two guys joined is very much like that. You know, we played a couple of gigs with a band called Pert Near Sandstone, and their fiddle player, Ryan Young, Dave asked him to play with him at a couple solo shows. And then when we wound up doing a show together, we're like, hey, Ryan, you want to jam with us? And it worked out that Pert Near and Trampled did shows together off and on for a couple of years because we're both from Minnesota. And then we kind of poached him away from them. But, you know, that's how he joined. And we did a tour with a band that had a cello player named Eamon McLean. And Ryan was trying to play a cello part on one of our songs, you know, in 2012 on our record Stars and Satellites for the song Alone. And he's like, I just can't do it. We should call this cello player we met last year. I'm like, okay, give him a call, you know. And then that guy wound up, you know, hanging out with us, and he was a great fit. So, like, all six of us have kind of joined, like, in a very similar way. Like, I know a guy. He's good.
Right.
You know?
What would you say are the characteristics in terms of, well, both as musicians, but also in terms of personality that have made the chemistry so good? I mean, what is it that you sort of share in common, or is it more that you are kind of a set of harmonious contrasts to one another? I mean, how would you explain the wonderful chemistry of Trampled by Turtles?
Musically, it's almost impossible to explain the chemistry. It's definitely there. I notice it, especially when I'm just trying to practice without any of the guys. You know, like, it is really hard to, like, just play the mandolin part for way so long and mean it when it's just me, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to just phone in that part when the whole band is playing.
Hmm.
Like, the chemistry, the musical chemistry is just, it's just there.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to quantify, and it's really hard to describe, and, you know, different positive musical chemistry exists with other people. But when it's the six of us, it's definitely something unique and special. Off stage, you know, we're all pretty laid back. We're all pretty quiet. We're all pretty friendly. I mean, we're not, you know, identical to each other, but we definitely get along with each other really well. And, you know, we used to have a joke about you could tell when someone's getting stressed out on tour because they become super polite. Instead of like, hey, man, could you hand me that bottle of water? It's like, excuse me, could you please hand me that bottle of water, please? You know? It's like, uh-oh, what's eating Eric? <You know?
laughs> I like that. So here you are together all these years later, and obviously not tired of it, and the fact that the original four are still there, and by all indications, just as happy and just as excited as you were back in 2003. How do you explain that? Because even the nicest people and most talented people in the world aren't necessarily happy being with the same group over a length of time like that.
Well, we did take a 19-month hiatus that we came off of in May of 2018 that we went on in October of 2016. We did have to spend some time apart. It did get to a point where I think probably because by all of our natures, we don't really, we are quiet and we are easygoing and we are all kind of like, hey, whatever you want is fine with me, you know, like, you know, preferring to leave from behind, I suppose. No one really knew how to talk about, you know, scheduling issues or being around each other too much, issues that were starting to rear up, until it all just kind of broke loose. And yeah, we didn't even hang out in the same room together for a year. There was really no horrible acrimony, but it wasn't a unanimous, consensual decision to do that.
Interesting.
So we did go through some stuff. One of the things that we learned from it is, like, it's cool to talk about how you're feeling. You know what I mean? And one of the things that, since we started playing again in May 2018, is we're not saying yes to every gig that comes our way. We are just, like, 6 months out, pointing to a month on a calendar and being like, unless Neil Young's calling, we're just going to pretty much take that month off, you know?
Taking time to breathe.
Yeah, you know, like, and it was a lesson that we had to learn kind of the hard way, but other bands have learned it a much harder way, so I'll still take it.
Right.
But yeah, it hasn't been without drama.
Well, that's healthy and understandable. In our closing couple of minutes, could you just say a word about what I understand to be Trampled by Turtles' intention to be a part of events that are meaningful beyond just great music? Like, for instance, this Labor of Love Music Festival coming up on September 1st, which is actually to lift up the theme of suicide prevention. It sounds, from what I've been told, like, it is important to you guys, not only to play fun concerts and make money and enjoy each other, but also to make a difference somehow.
Well, part of that is, you know, I think as human beings, we all kind of have a responsibility to do good when we have the opportunity. And when you're, you know, one of the things that you don't really know about until it happens to you is that when you're in a band such as this, people do ask you for that, you know, and it kind of opens your eyes to, like, oh, geez, you know, like, there's some opportunities here. frankly, we could play a benefit show every day, every concert we ever play, because there's enough of them out there to do it. So unfortunately, we do have to be kind of picky and choosy. But, you know, an event like this seems important, and it's also kind of a unique. We've never really been asked to be part of a fundraiser like this exactly, to deal with, like, suicide prevention and awareness. And the fact that it was close to home over Labor Day weekend helped a lot, too.
Sure. Well, yeah, I know a lot of people are really excited and pleased that you're going to be part of this. And I would certainly be remiss before I let you go if I didn't ask you where this wonderful name comes from, Trampled by Turtles.
Well, I'm actually the one who thought of that and suggested it, and it was suggested as a way to make a more traditional-sounding band name more palatable. Now I think people think differently, but in 2003 we kind of felt like, well, playing this music, we really should probably have a name like Valley or River or Boys or Mountain or all four of them in the same name. And it just wasn't, we didn't like it. It just really wasn't our personality. And I was like, well, we could be called something like Trampled by Turtles. And I was like, oh, I'd much rather be called that than anything else. So it's stuck, and it's definitely been good to us. A fun little fact about that is after we agreed to call ourselves that, I Googled it to make sure that it wasn't some other band's name.
Hmm.
And it was not, but all the hits in 2003 were about a coral reef support group out in Hawaii that was documenting the damage done to coral reefs. And a lot of it's done by boats and other sorts of human interference, but some of it is done by giant sea turtles that will scratch themselves on coral.
Ah.
And they're so heavy that they'll crush it and wreck it, but it's kind of considered acceptable damage because it's a natural phenomena. Anyway, that damage was labeled as Trampled by Turtles.
But now, not that it's funny. I mean, not that it's funny, but it
is funny. You know, like, and unfortunately, now we've made it hard to find that group's research.
Yeah, right. Well, I guess that's another benefit you'll have to play. But in the meantime, first you need to play this upcoming benefit, the Labor of Love Music Festival on Sunday, September 1st, out in New Munster. And then you have other Wisconsin dates coming up that we'll tell our listeners about as well. And you guys have a website where people can learn a little bit more about you and can seek out your wonderful recordings. And Eric Berry, mandolin player for Trampled by Turtles, I really appreciate you taking time to speak with me on the morning show today. This has really been fun. Thank you so much, and best wishes to you and the rest of your great group.
Well, thank you, Greg. I wish you the same.
And for more information about the Labor of Love Music Festival coming up this Sunday, September 1st, featuring Trampled by Turtles, you can go to the website justliveinc.org. That's justliveinc.org. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We finish out today's morning show by talking about the ferociously competitive struggle to gain admission to the most prestigious colleges and universities in the country. When one is interested in gaining admission to a place like Harvard or Yale or Princeton or Notre Dame or any other number of top-tier schools, it is simply not sufficient to have a high grade point average and impressive test score results. One must also demonstrate outstanding skill in extracurricular activities and demonstrate outstanding work in the community. One resource that a number of high school students across the country have made use of is called Project Merit, which was created more than two decades ago by a California educator named Susan Tatsui Darcy, who, by the way, this year was named California Mother of the Year. She's just written a book called Beat the College Admissions Game with Project Merit, which spells out all that this resource has to offer to a high school student wanting to create a truly meaningful and impressive community project. I began my interview with Susan Tatsui Darcy by asking her to explain just how competitive the world of college and university admissions has become.
Well, when you're looking at really selective colleges like the ones you named, there's about 200 of them, then, you know, they're 4%, 5% acceptance rate for Stanford and Harvard, Princeton. So it does get crazy. It gets ridiculous that you that students can't get in or can't even be, it's not even considered a target school if you have a 4.6 GPA, a perfect SAT or ACT score, and you're the MVP of the football team. You know, it's just, you can't be, it's not a guarantee. But that's only for the 200, 400, maybe 400 colleges. There's 4,000 colleges in the United States, and many of them are clamoring to get students. So they're advertising, they're out seeking students to attend their universities, and some universities are actually closing because there isn't enough, they don't have the students that they need to fill their spaces to stay open.
Right. It's such
a college.
Yeah, it's such a strange scenario in which you have some of these this one kind of school in which the name is so well known and the thought of going there is so desperately coveted by so many that they are in that one scenario. And then you're, of course, exactly right. There are many perfectly fine colleges and universities who are, in a sense, on the other end, struggling. And then, of course, plenty of schools happily somewhere in the middle in a place of a little more normalcy. But we're talking about a really confusing situation. Explain to our listeners this thing that I mentioned briefly, which is not the primary focus of this interview, but I think we might as well just talk about it briefly. This huge scandal that has kind of rocked the world of college admissions and involved several high-level Hollywood celebrities who have engaged in some fraud for which they're going to dearly pay a price. For anyone who has not followed that scandal, what are we talking about here in terms of the kind of misdeeds that have been brought to light?
Well, it's still unfolding. I mean, every week we're finding new situations. But basically what we're looking at are parents who are so desperate to get their children into name brand colleges that they bribe SAT coaches, SAT proctors, so their students can go into a room to take a test and they either change the answers to give them better scores, or they allow people to take their students' place in the actual test itself. So somebody else is taking the test who can get a higher score. They're bribing coaches to say that this particular child is the best in the country and we should accept the student to our college so that they can be on our team, when in fact these students don't even play the sport. You know, they don't know how to sail or play tennis or whatever the sport is. And it's gotten ridiculous because what the bottom line is, what's happening is parents are bribing, they're cheating, they're using their power, their money and their power and their celebrity status to get their kids into college. But they're not getting their kids into these colleges for their children. They're getting their kids into college for themselves. And that's a really sad part, is they're doing it because they themselves are insecure about their kids, or they're insecure themselves, where they have to boast about their children going to a particular college, and that means that much, that they would actually destroy their own children's self-esteem, because the children of those parents who've done the scandalous deeds are the ones who are really, really suffering, because they know that their parents don't believe in them. Their parents don't have the time for them to help them build their skills or build their academic prowess so they can go out and enter these colleges on their own merit. It's such a devastating thing for the kids. I feel so sorry for those children of these parents, because the parents, and we can segue into the reason we're having this interview, if the parents would have put their energy and their money and their celebrity into a project with their children would get into the top universities. They'd even get scholarship money. And their kids would be able to stand tall and be proud of who they are because they did something that mattered. Mm. So when these parents have these deep pockets and they're spending $1 million to get their kids into an Ivy League college, instead of spending that $1 million that's going to destroy your child's self-esteem, let's put that behind a project. Like, let's say your child decides that this fire in this huge, huge fire that's happening in Brazil right now in the Amazon rainforest is awful, and we need to stop this, kind of like Leonardo DiCaprio just put $5 million down for this. And these parents with these deep pockets say, you know, if they help their kids understand the devastation that we're going to feel as a civilization when we lose 20% of our oxygen to this rainforest fire, and the kids go out there and they go do something, and they take that money and say, you know, I'm going to spend $1 million to do this, this, and this, that would be a project, because it's something that they care about. It's something that they do on their own. Their parents, I'm not saying the parents should go do this or hire somebody to do it. The parents should support their children and saying, yeah, let's go down there. Let's figure out what's going on. How can we support these indigenous people so that they can protect the rainforest and we can all survive? You know, just really basic things.
Absolutely.
Support their child with a project, with the guidance, and with the money. If they want to put money into something to pave the way for them to get into college, that would be an ethical and a great way to do this, because their children come out on top, the colleges come out on top, we as a civilization come out on top, so it's a win-win-win all the way around if they're going to use their money in some fashion as opposed to using it to cheat or bribe or buy a building on the college campus.
Right. Before we get to Project Merit, I'd like you to explain when somebody, when a young person applies to a place like Stanford or Harvard or Yale or, you know, the kind of schools that we are talking about, how do these kind of projects or extracurricular participation, how does that figure into the admissions process versus a young person's academic record? I mean, how are these things, how do they tend to figure into the computations that a given university's admissions program will engage in order to make the difficult choices that they have to make?
Good question. Your GPA is the most important part of your application. So we have an application, you put in you list your GPA and you list your SAT or ACT score. Those are two scores that are heavily weighted in the admissions process. The next thing that comes into line is what you do. Who are you, and how did you take advantage of your school or your community? What have you done to show us that you have this passion, you have integrity, that you've got persistence, that you've got what it'll take to be successful at our really, really highly esteemed university, and then go out after you're done with us here into the world and do something where we can say you're one of our alums. So it's a question that the student needs to ask themselves. Is, you know, playing in a band in my high school when there's 100,000 kids in the country doing this, am I going to stand out? You know, I've got a 4.6 GPA, I've got a perfect SAT score, and there's thousands, tens of thousands of kids in that same boat. So if they're all out there, how do I differentiate myself? If I'm playing basketball or baseball or a dance or do something, how many of the kids are out there doing the same thing that I'm doing? When the kid does a project, they are the CEO and founder of their nonprofit or their business that they start. They are the patent holder for their device that they engineer. They are the author, published author of the books that they write. They public speak. They speak for TED. We're doing a TED in 2 weeks, and we've got all of our kids going up with their projects, talking about their what they've done. And it's an incredible way for the colleges to look at this and go to TED and just, you know, type TED and type in the name of the student and see that they spoke at a TED conference. It looks wonderful on your application. Way better than, you know, doing something where, you know, like Eagle Scout is a great, great honor. But how many Eagle Scouts are there out there? And the projects that the Eagle Scouts do is actually required. You know, so if it becomes required, just like a project at school is required for a grade, then it loses steam in the admissions process because they see that you did it, which is great, and they like it, but there's a lot of people doing it. And the way that Project Merit separates the kids out from all their peers is that they're the only ones doing this. And when I help the students figure out what they want to do when they do a project, we go online and just see who else is doing this, and do we really need to be there? Let's go do something that needs our help, and let's go out there and do this. And the student does it completely 100% by themselves. I hire mentors to work with them, and they support them, but the mentors are trained to not do the work. The mentors are trained to educate, guide, support. but the student does all of the work on their own. And they even write press releases so they can get on radio shows like this and TV shows, and they get tons of press in the papers. And these are things that they can take and put on their application, just saying, I just received, like, for instance, my daughter, I think, she was a feature story for 36 articles and made 2 magazine covers. She wrote that in one of her essays. That would definitely catch the attention of an admissions officer, because it's outside of your school. It's outside of what's required. It's outside of your church. It's something that comes from your heart, and you really do stand out.
Hmm. We're speaking with Susan Tatsui Darcy about a book she's just published called Beat the College Admissions Game with Project Merit. Project Merit is something which she herself created. How long ago did you create Project Merit?
Back in the 90s. So we've been doing it for a long time. I'm I founded a school called Merit Academy, and it's for accelerated students here in California. Now it's nationwide because we do one-on-one classes. And part of Merit Academy requires students to do a project. Even though I just finished saying that it shouldn't be a project that you do at school, our projects are such that it's not graded. It's something that students just do because they need to get into great colleges, and all of our kids do get into, you know, really top-tier colleges. But it's a place for them to hone in on who they are, and that's why they all do individual projects themselves. It's not group projects, and they go out and get volunteers.
Explain kind of how the process works for a given student with a given project, and I'm particularly curious to know how tricky it is to make sure that this remains the student's project, and that you and your mentors, for instance, aren't exerting too much influence or guidance, or giving, in a sense, too much assistance, so it, in a sense, no longer belongs to the student the same way it would if it were just something they were doing completely on their own. Explain how that tricky matter is handled.
That's a really good question, because it's something that we do struggle with here, because a lot of students start off with a project they're excited about, but, you know, being 13, 14, 15 years old and being teenagers, they lose interest halfway through. So we have to really rally them back to focus on what their goal is. So we do a lot of pulling them back in, and then also motivating them, just saying, oh, you were supposed to work on your website last week. How far did you get? And oftentimes they don't get anywhere, you know. So sometimes during the session they have to work with either me or one of the mentors. We've got like 50 mentors, and with one of our mentors, and they just work together, you know. And the mentor isn't doing the work, but the mentor is sitting there with them, because without sitting there, sometimes it takes students a little push or a little oomph to get them, you know, off their comfort zone, out of their comfort zone, and back into action. To work on that. That's a really good question. Another problem I have is that a lot of the parents get involved, and they start doing things. Like, I have a student who wanted to create an Uber for children, you know, because right now children can't call an Uber and take off, and he wanted to create this. And he was he wanted to be a businessman, and he was in 11th grade, and we were laying out the whole plan, and he came up with this genius idea, and we laid it all out. I mean, I'm sitting there watching him do this, and each week I'd say, okay, we'll work on your logo, and he came back with a great logo, and I said, let's figure out all the problems. You need to call the attorneys and find out, you know, what's going on legally, you know, what's going to happen if there's a car accident. What if a kid says, take me to Disneyland instead of take me to school? What, you know, how do we protect parents from that? And to make sure that the Uber drivers are safe with these children in the back seats. So he went through all of that and started doing this. And we laid out his app for the phone, and he started coding. And he's not a coder, but I had him work with one of my, we call him college advisory specialists, one of our CASs who is a mentor, and helped him design this. But then his father stepped in and just said, and he's Indian, and his dad says, well, I'm going to India next month. I'm just going to get one of my programmers in India to do it at a fraction of the cost, and we'll get done in a month. So his father took the project away from him and went to India, and it didn't get done in a month. It got done in 10 months, and it was too late for college admissions because his dad didn't understand what we're trying to do, and it demoralized the student. I mean, this kid who was so excited and thinking, I can go to college, but, you know, I might be able to pay for college myself because I think this is going to make money, and he had laid out the whole business plan. He was so excited. He had a sparkle in his eye, and he was really excited. And then after, I could see it. I just saw it right before me just change. He just transformed into this you know, kind of dumpy little kid. And he just showed up at meetings and just say things like, "Oh, I don't." I'd say, "Well, how's it going? You know, did he do this? Did they program that? Did they look at this problem that we found?" And he'd say, "I don't know." He goes, "I don't speak their language, and my dad isn't going to go there for another month, so we're not going to hear anything for at least a month." And it was just a disaster. The student felt so badly about what was going on that he ended up not even applying to any of the colleges we were originally going to apply to. He ended up applying to community college and just kind of bowed out because he felt that he was cheating the system. The student did.
Fascinating.
So, yeah, so it's really important to have kids do their own projects. And for me, I have two daughters, and my oldest daughter went to Stanford, and my youngest to Claremont McKenna College here in California, which is a wonderful college. And both of them did projects, and I was so grateful that they picked projects in an area where I don't have expertise because I'm not a scientist. My daughter's an ER doctor today, and my other daughter has her MBA from Northwestern. And the older daughter built a hydrogen fuel cell, and she was the first middle school student in the world to do so. And because I had no experience in that area, it was really great for me because I would just say, I don't know. I would take her to different events. They flew her to, you know, the Department of Energy flew her to Washington, D.C. And then all the adults would come to me because they'd see an adult standing there figuring I was controlling the project like it is in most schools, right? And I said, I'm the driver. I'm the legal adult here, and I have no idea what the kids are doing. If you have questions, ask them. And it really empowered the students because they laughed at me. They said, "Oh, you don't know anything about chemistry." And I said, "Nope, I don't, and I don't care to. I want you to do it all. You talk to the press. You talk to all the engineers, and you figure out what you need to do." And the kids were able to stand on their own two feet and be really proud of who they are or who they were at the time, which made all the difference in the world, you know, in terms of their personal self-esteem. They had such confidence. And the cool thing about this, the parents who are listening may be interested in it, is that when kids have confidence because they are doing something that they know is wonderful, they know that the press is picking up on this, that must mean that I'm not just smart like my mom says or my dad says I'm cute. It's none of that. It's that the world outside is looking at what this kid is doing, and it makes them feel proud. And when they feel proud, they don't do drugs. They don't get involved in sex, you know, where they get pregnant in high school. They don't get involved in gang violence. These kids, I never hear of that happening. It's just because they feel really proud of who they are, they don't get themselves mixed up in those worlds. And that's something in itself that I would think parents would be interested in.
Right. I want to be sure to talk about a couple of projects that I found very, very impressive. And I should mention that people can go to meritworld.com to read about some of the marvelous projects that have been created through Project Merit. One of them that my eyes just lit up is called ASL for Kids. And this involves sign language and preschoolers. Can you say a quick word about this particular project?
Yes, this is a girl who had done some research learning that ASL, you know, American Sign Language, was really great for kids who can't speak. So, you know, when babies are frustrated and they cry and you don't know, what is it, their diaper, are they hungry, something bothering them, the kids learn to sign. So they can say, "I'm hungry." They can sign hungry. They can sign diaper is wet, you know, for preschoolers or for babies, infants. But it's a great way for communication because kids don't have the verbal skills to describe and communicate with their parents. ASL is a wonderful medium, and it's also great for elders, too. You know, as people get older, they can't hear you.
Right, exactly. No, it's just
ASL to communicate.
Yeah, neat way to kind of broaden that. I also really loved reading about a project called Wash Up, WASHUP, which stands for Worthless Antibacterial Soap Harms Us Permanently. This is a really fascinating project, and just the name alone jumps out at us. Can you say a quick word about Wash Up?
Yes, this is a student who wanted to stop people from using antibacterial soap. She actually did an experiment and showed with two petri dishes, one with regular soap and one with her antibacterial soap, and she put bacteria in the dishes. and it didn't. And the antibacterial soap didn't kill more germs than the other, and yet it causes all kinds of other problems in the environment. So she went out and she actually converted all the public schools in her county to go from antibacterial soap to regular soap, with notes that went home to all the families of these students that went to the schools to say, stop buying antibacterial soap. So it was a huge coup for her, and she got into her top college with this project.
Fascinating.
And right.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, and now I've got a student who is worried about the fires in California, and he lives really close to Paradise, which is a city that was completely demolished thanks to the fires from last year in 2018. So what he did was he engineered a device that looks like kind of like a balloon, a canister balloon, so that if a spark lands on the balloon or the canister, it explodes with fire retardant that goes out 100 feet, so immediately snuffs out a spark so that the fire doesn't start off in an area where the fire department can't get to and grows into 20,000 acres and takes 2 months to extinguish. He couldn't understand it. He says, I don't understand why fires take so long to contain. And he is in the process of doing this. He's actually speaking at our TED conference on September 15th.
Fascinating.
But that project is going to get him into all the major colleges, because he's 14 years old, and he is just headstrong and in it, and he's working with our chemical engineers to devise this this process, and they're doing experiments to see what works and what doesn't work, and they're going to create the container and put it together and do a demonstration to show people how it works, and then he's going to work with the fire departments in California, Cal Fire, and he's going to work with PG&E to help get this problem solved so that California doesn't become the huge problem that it was last year.
Right. So if people are intrigued by Project Merit and feel like this might possibly be something that could be helpful to, for instance, one of their children or grandchildren, to possibly have such a project launched with the help of Project Merit, how do they get more information?
Best way is to get the book, Beat the College Admissions Game, with Project Merit. You can get that on Amazon. Another way you can do that, if you don't, that's the least expensive. It's like $10 to get the book, and it leads you through all the steps from brainstorming to finding mentors to finding funds to pay for your project, and then looking at how to write press releases and get the press you need so that you can show the colleges what you've done. The other part is you can work with anybody here at Merit. So you can call Merit at 831-462-5655, and we work with students all around the world to help them brainstorm and complete a project. So we work with kids, and then we also have mentors all over the world who can help each student do different projects based on whatever it is. So it's exciting, it's fun, and it'll change your kids' lives. That's the thing that's the most empowering part about doing a project is they become independent, they become interesting people, they become people that colleges would want to admit to their colleges, but it changes the child. It changes the child, and it gives them hope, it gives them some power, and it just prepares them to be really nice, wonderful, successful citizens. Hmm.
Susan Tatsui Darcy is the creator of Project Merit, and again, the title of her book is Beat the College Admissions Game with Project Merit. Susan Tatsui Darcy, it was great to speak with you today on The Morning Show. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, a really interesting conversation about a really interesting book. It's titled Sudden Courage, Youth in France Confront the Germans, 1940 to 1945. In this book, author Ronald C. Rossbottom explores the many and varied ways in which young people in France, teenagers to young adults in their early 20s, were part of the resistance against the Nazis who were occupying France. And sometimes that resistance took very subtle form, and sometimes it was very overt and, in a sense, aggressive. But it took courage and ingenuity to effect resistance against the Germans. And his book explores all of this in fascinating detail. He is well known for a previous book called When Paris Went Dark, which examines every facet of the Nazi occupation of the city of Paris. Again, this book, Sudden Courage, will be the topic of tomorrow's morning show. We want to remind you that the morning show is archived on our website, WGTD.org, and the morning show is available as a podcast on all of the major podcast platforms, including Spotify, Google Podcast, and Apple Podcast. And you want to search for the program on